You are Locked On Rockets, your daily Houston Rockets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Happy Monday. Welcome in to a new episode and a new week of Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast commentary on all things Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. As we chat this Sunday evening, it's almost Monday, but the odds are when you're listening to this, it probably will be. The Rockets are a little over 24 hours removed from perhaps the most feel-good win of the entire season, 118-112 over the Warriors at Golden State. If you want a full recap of that, I strongly encourage you to check out our archives. Listen to Sunday's show where we broke down all the things that went right, starting with Chris Paul, 23 points, 17 assists, a true turn-back-the-clock game for the Hall of Fame point guard, hashtag playoff CP3, hashtag point god. Also, a bigger Rockets front line, Kenneth Faried at the 4, P.J. Tucker at the 3, Clint Capela at the center spot, his second game back, even without James Harden. The Rockets, between Paul's brilliance, Eric Gordon leading the team in scoring with 25, and then a big front line that had 35 rebounds just between those big three and actually out-rebounded a larger Golden State team, 48-46. The Rockets were able to get a crucial win and salvage a split of the road trip. I think most of us expected going in a split of a road trip at LA and at Golden State. The Laker game on the front end, when the Rockets led by 19, was the one more likely to get the win. Unfortunately, the Rockets and Scott Foster let that slip away. It is what it is. But even without James Harden, neck injury, missed it also with the flu. He's questionable for Monday against the Hawks. We'll see what his status is at shoot-around in the morning. But even with those headwinds, the Rockets found a way to get what they needed, which was one of those two games on the road. And now the Rockets have an easier week on tap, at least on paper. It is going to be a lot of games in a short time span. Monday, the Hawks at home. Wednesday at Charlotte. Thursday at home against Miami. So it's three games in four nights, including a back-to-back. But on paper, the Rockets should be favored in each of those games. So we'll have a lot to discuss on the basketball front in the days ahead. If you want coverage of the Warriors game, check out Sunday's show. Today, with this being the week that the calendar turns to March, and we're going to lose perspective on that with all the games coming up, but Friday is March 1st. That is an important date on the NBA calendar because that's when players need to be released from their former teams in order to be playoff eligible with their new teams. So in effect, March 1st is the closing date on the NBA buyout calendar. Not that all buyouts have to be agreed to by that time with their new teams, but they need to have secured their release from their old team. If they are not released by Friday, in essence, it's not happening. And for a Rockets team that is still not at full strength, James Harden, Iman Shumpert still questionable, Harden with the neck injury slash flu, they don't think it's that severe, but perhaps with the Hawks being a bad team, they can rest him one more game. Shumpert, a little more alarming, and that's a knee issue he's had trouble with in the past, more of a mileage situation. We'll have to see if his recent absence, the two games on the road trip, questionable tomorrow, has the Rockets more cautious and looking for reinforcements at the wing spot, especially with Kenneth Faried's newfound ability to play the four in addition to the five. Again, you want more on that, check out our recap show after the Warriors game, which we extol the virtues of just how significant Faried was at that fourth spot playing alongside Clint Capela. Or it could just be, as far as the Rockets are concerned, that Friday is the date that they look to add depth. Because this is a team throughout the year that has had depth issues, and right now they feel like they have a good nine-man rotation when healthy, but then to some degree it can fall off a cliff. They have Nene, but he's a five only. Beyond their original nine, assuming health, and that's with Harden and Shumpert back, it's unclear where they go at the end of the bench, and though at the moment they have both Terrence Jones, former Rocket, and rookie Chris Chioza on 10-day contracts, the Rockets do have room under the luxury tax for at least one fully guaranteed contract. It could go to Daniel House Jr. to bring him back. It could be to someone that secures a buyout for another team, or who knows, it could be to someone that, say, they just like from the G League, such as Chioza or Terrence Jones. Perhaps Jones, who's with the big league Rockets at the moment, Maybe he gets his opportunity this week with 3 games in 4 nights. We'll have to see. But the point is, the Rockets, those 10-day contracts, in effect what they did, they allow Houston to buy time to get until March 1st. Even for those that have a wary view of Tillman Fertitta, the owner, and spoiler alert, we're going to be talking about him a lot on today's show. Even if you have a wary view, you can still sign at least one guaranteed contract and be below the luxury tax. So the reason the Rockets have 2 10-days, it's not because they're going to try and do nothing but 10 days the rest of the year. It's because they're trying to get to this March 1st deadline, then take stock of the landscape. By that point, you'll know who the buyouts are, who the buyouts aren't. And that also plays into your Daniel House Jr. calculus, because with House at the G League level, his two-way contract out of NBA days, the Rockets are effectively balancing what's left in the buyout market versus Daniel House Jr. to see what is the bigger need, what's the best player available, and then that will dictate their decisions as far as what they do with at least one fully guaranteed roster spot, in my estimation, going forward for the remainder of this season. And when we discuss a lot of these issues on Facebook, on Twitter, on our various social medias, the blogs, whatever it may be, the one common theme that I sense from a lot of Rockets fans is skepticism over relative new owner Tillman Fertitta, in part because there's not a track record. And in fact, this is his first full season. He officially took over in October 2017, but by that point, a lot of the spending had already been set. And with that team, again, number one, you already handed out contracts due to the Chris Paul trade in the offseason. And secondly, the team winning 65 games and being the best team in the NBA, at least during the regular season, it would take an idiot to screw that up. This is the first full season in which we have Fertitta in the offseason to grade, and a season that, while not dreadful at 34-25, clearly is not to expectations. It could be better. There are potential upgrades that you could bring in, and it's a relative new owner without a lot of track record. So everything gets blown out of proportion because it's such a small sample size. And Fertitta, with the combination of moves that have saved cost, moves at the deadline, shedding Brandon Knight's salary, Marquise Chris, and a deal for Iman Shumpert, which, while a basketball upgrade, was a bit cheaper, and then moving James Ennis, Nick Stauskas, Wade Baldwin, briefly Rockets, as part of the three-way Shumpert deal on deadline day, the Rockets getting beneath the tax, and it left a sour taste in a lot of Rockets fans' mouths that in a season where you're looking for upgrades to get over the hump, the Rockets basically being one game away from the title a year ago, and now having James Harden in his prime, the reigning MVP, and one of the more historical scoring stretches in NBA history, perhaps the greatest in modern NBA history, and you see the Rockets cutting costs. And with an owner that doesn't have a track record of spending, there are some alarm bells with that. I get it, and with this being the week of buyout season reaching its peak, or at least its conclusion, to where at that point the Rockets will be able to make a decision about what that at least one guaranteed roster spot is earmarked for, be it Daniel House Jr. or someone else, then Tillman Fertitta's willingness to spend, and they do have most of their mid-level exception left, about $3.5 million, it's fair to say that Fertitta is under the microscope, and his willingness to spend, and whether he's willing to go into the luxury tax, will play a role in many of these decisions. And what I'm going to try and do in today's show, because this has gnawed at me for a while, if you follow me on Twitter, at Ben Dubose, you've probably sensed this to some degree with my responses on the Fertitta issue. And what I want to outline is why I think, in my opinion, Fertitta is taking too much abuse from the Rockets fan community, at least in the social media circles that I run in. And the reason that this is such a significant issue to me, if you don't believe in Tillman Fertitta, that's a somewhat fatal flaw. Fatal might be a slight stretch. It's not impossible to overcome it, but ownership is perhaps the biggest competitive advantage, and it can be the biggest competitive disadvantage in the modern NBA. And in a league where the bar is so high, the current Warriors are seeing more East teams get top-heavy as well. We know what LeBron is trying to put together in the Lakers. If you have an owner that is reluctant to even pay the luxury tax, then it can be very difficult in a market like Houston to actually win a title. And that's why I take some of these criticisms so seriously, because it's not just about this year. If you truly believe that Fertitta is so cheap that he won't pay the tax, even in future seasons with James Harden and Chris Paul, who, by the way, one piece of evidence in Fertitta's favor, they signed Chris Paul on day one of free agency to a 4-year max deal at better than $40 million a year in his latter seasons. I'm not sure there was a deal anywhere close to that on the market for Chris Paul at this time. So from the outset, that has me a little bit suspicious that they're trying to pitch pennies if they were willing to do that in the first minute of free agency to Chris Paul. But we'll have more on that as the show progresses. What I want to stress now is why I view this issue as so important. Because if you want to say that mistakes that have been made, and clearly there have been some, the Rockets are 34 and 25, within single digits of 500, even though we're almost 60 games into the season. If a GM like Daryl Morey makes mistakes, or if there are coaches that don't optimize the roster the way you would like to see them do, those can be rectified. Human beings, they make mistakes, they learn, and they grow from them. If an owner is unwilling to spend, even with James Harden in his prime and the team a year ago being so close to the title, it's tough to see in what scenario that he would. And when I say unwilling to spend, I mean at a luxury tax level. Now, the repeater tax, which I do think the Rockets are trying to avoid, which kicks in when you're in the luxury tax three times in 4 years, which with Chris Paul on a four-year deal could become a consideration. That's a big deal, but I don't really consider that a competitive disadvantage if Fertitta is unwilling to go there, because nearly all NBA teams are unwilling to go there. You can question just how significant it is, but the reality is, with 90% of NBA teams being reluctant and refusing based on the current collective bargaining agreement, hardly anyone has gone there. I don't see that as a competitive disadvantage. If he is even willing to go in the luxury tax, then yeah, that's a pretty big competitive disadvantage, and it's why I take it very seriously, because if I believe that, then it's pretty hard to see how this team can actually win a title with the bar as high as it is in the modern NBA. So that's why I view it as a very serious criticism, but it's also one where, in my opinion, the cart is ahead of the horse, with a lot of fans feeling relatively disappointed by the year, at least to this point, wanting a punching bag, and since we know Daryl Morey, Mike D'Antoni, James Harden, the leadership, the brain trust of the organization, they have much longer track records, especially Harden on the court with the amazing numbers he's putting up, then with Tillman being a relative novice, it's much easier to kind of shoehorn everything into a narrative in which he's the guy to blame because he is relatively new. But number one, I don't think it's entirely fair. And secondly, I don't think it's accurate. And I think it's crucial to understand whether it's accurate or not, because if it is, it's a pretty damn serious indictment. But my hope by the end of this podcast, I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong. I'm not trying to insinuate that Tillman Fertitta is a great owner, because we don't know that yet. It's too soon to tell. What my goal is to tell you, and I'll do this over the following 15, 20 minutes, is to break down both the trade deadline leading up to February 7th and what has happened since then in the buyout market, why I think, again, the cart is ahead of the horse. It's not that you should view Tillman by the end of this as the world's greatest owner. No, it's just that I think by the end of it, I hope at least you'll be convinced to take a deep breath, breathe, and while I'm not saying there are no red flags, I'm not saying there's no reason for any skepticism, at the same time, I do think it's too easy and far too premature to draw conclusions at this stage. So stick with me, and I'm going to break down what the Rockets have done financially leading up to the trade deadline and what they have done since, and why, in my opinion, some of the takes regarding Tillman Fertitta far too aggressive and too premature. Now, jumping back in to Monday's show, which I titled A Relative Defense of Tillman Fertitta, and the reason I use the word relative, I'm not saying that the new owner of the Rockets took over in October 2017 is someone that you should clearly say is in the top anything in the NBA. Quite frankly, it's been such a limited sample that it would be tough to draw any conclusions. However, based on social media, especially locally here in Houston, but some nationally as well, I do think some of the takes negatively after the Rockets shed salaries to get underneath the luxury tax have been over the top. And in these final two segments of our show, I'm going to explore it both from a trade deadline perspective and a buyout perspective. First, the trade deadline. What we know happened is the deal for Iman Shumpert. What we don't 100% know, but we have some idea, are the moves that came, or were attempted, I should say, before that. And the reason that's relevant, it's not just about the deal, it's also about the timing. The Shumpert deal was completed at effectively 7 p.m. Houston time, 19 hours before the 2 p.m. Houston time deadline on Thursday. It was 7 p.m. Wednesday night. So effectively, this was a deadline deal. It went down to the wire. Why? Because it wasn't just about the money. We have heard the Rockets extensively linked this year for example, to Jimmy Butler. That was a much bigger name than Iman Shumpert. Rockets willing to give up all of their future assets for future first-round picks. They just simply didn't have enough in their war chest. It was an asset issue, not a money issue. And beyond just going after Jimmy Butler, it was reported by Adrian Wojnarowski, the best reporter on the planet, that the Rockets were willing to extend Jimmy Butler, which would have given his supermax, which would kick up his salary by at least $10 million a year relative to his old deal by whoever signs him this summer, then yeah, that would have been extensive luxury tax territory for the foreseeable future for Tillman Fertitta. That was not a problem. The Rockets, they were willing to give up their assets. It just wasn't enough. And it's a theme I'm going to be repeating a lot. What's happened after that is people conflating a Daryl Morey problem for a Tillman Fertitta problem. And to be clear, it's not Daryl Morey's fault that he doesn't have assets. Well, I suppose it is from the standpoint of he cashed in most of his assets, not just future picks, but mainly attractive, young-ish players on friendly contracts, Montrezl Harrell, Pat Beverly, Lou Williams, in the trade for Chris Paul, which I think has been quite worthwhile. But for a contender which doesn't have high picks, it takes a long time. It hasn't even been 2 years since the Rockets made that blockbuster deal for Chris Paul. Well, the Rockets just did not have the assets to get Jimmy Butler. That's a Daryl Morey problem. And again, it's not saying that he's a bad GM. No, that's not even a mistake. He used those assets quite well. It's just the Rockets couldn't get that deal done, not because they wouldn't spend, but because the GM just did not have what it took to coax Minnesota into giving up their franchise player. So that one didn't happen, but that was a deal. Yeah, many of the assets that they ultimately used, salary filler, they went with Brandon Knight and Marquise Chris for Shumpert. Well, it would have been Brandon Knight plus four picks. That was the rumored offer to Minnesota for Jimmy Butler. It just didn't happen because Minnesota didn't think the assets were attractive enough. I think you'd be a fool to think the Rockets didn't place calls if they were after Butler, after Anthony Davis, after Tobias Harris. I'm sure they were in the market for those names as well. Unfortunately, same story as Jimmy Butler. They just did not have the assets. It's also been pretty well reported that the Rockets were in talks with Memphis deadline week about a trade involving JaMychal Green and Garrett Temple. That would not have cut costs significantly, and it probably would have had the Rockets above the luxury tax line. Unfortunately, it seemed Memphis decided to pivot or stall, whatever it may be, depending on which report you believe, and ultimately they went with a deal for Avery Bradley. That would not have been as cheap as the Shumpert deal. The Shumpert deal only happened once all the other possibilities were exhausted, and at that point, it's not like Shumpert for Brandon Knight and Marquise Chris, two guys that were not playing, is a basketball downgrade. You'd be an idiot to argue that. No, it's just the best deal the Rockets could come up with, and also a first-round pick in there, of course, to offload the contract to Brandon Knight. It's the best deal the Rockets could come up with within 24 hours of the deadline. If it were just about shedding money and getting closer to the luxury tax, which that deal coupled with ditching the end-of-bench guys that I mentioned earlier allowed them to do, you could have done that same deal, Knight and Chris for Shumpert, the three-way, weeks before that, and saved even more money, because these contracts are prorated throughout the season. If you wanted to save money, why would you even wait until the deadline to do that? You could have done it earlier. They didn't, because they were trying to get bigger names. It just didn't work out. And it goes back to that theme. What you're saying is a Tillman Fertitta issue, in many cases, is a Daryl Morey issue. And that is the frustration that I have, because a lot of these issues, again, with Daryl, are not even mistakes. In the case of the assets, some of it has to do with Chris Paul. But even with regards to his mistakes with putting the roster together, James Ennis never filled the Trevor Ariza role like they hoped he would. Carmelo Anthony, I don't know that it was Daryl's idea so much as it was Chris Paul. Clearly, it didn't work out. Michael Carter-Williams, it wasn't a full guarantee, but regardless, they had been after him a couple of times even before signing him this past offseason. They viewed him as a lottery ticket. It didn't work out. So some of the issues that they had to fix this year, and to Daryl's credit, he's made up for them, signing the likes of Kenneth Faried, Austin Rivers, Daniel House Jr. during the season. Again, he's made up for them, but those were initial issues because they misidentified. And it happens. None of us panic because Daryl Morey is one of the best GMs in basketball, and he hits far more times than he misses. That said, he's not perfect. But in this case, because Morey is so well-respected, and the same goes for Mike D'Antoni and the established brain trust, there's a tendency that I have seen to force issues onto Tillman Fertitta because it is easier with him being the new guy in the room to assume that anything goes wrong must be his fault. In the case of the Shumpert deal, no, the Rockets didn't have an effort to get below the tax at all costs. If they did, it wouldn't have taken until the deadline, because they would have saved a lot more money. It would have been a lot easier to get under the tax had you executed a trade deadline like that well before the deadline. They didn't, because they wanted bigger moves. It's just when the bigger moves didn't work out, then with Shumpert being a bit cheaper. And by the way, Daryl Morey has been after Iman Shumpert before. So even in regards to that move, it would be silly to say that there's nothing but finances involved in that. The Rockets, under a different owner, Les Alexander, July 1st, 2017, they almost acquired Shumpert then. I remember back then a lot of folks panned it around NBA Twitter, not understanding why, and the Rockets have long believed that Shumpert is ideal in their system, and they nearly went with him before they signed PJ Tucker with the taxpayer MLE. So there's plenty of precedent that shows you the Rockets value and believe in Shumpert in their system. Maybe you don't fully, and that's fine. You don't have to believe in everything they do, but it's not just a Tillman Fertitta decision. It's possible you are also disagreeing with Daryl Morey's value judgment, and you might be right. Daryl is not perfect, but again, the theme that I'm trying to hit home over and over is that there are many people, in my estimation, that are conflating Daryl Morey issues for Tillman Fertitta issues, and that's a big deal because, in terms of predictive value for this franchise going forward, if Daryl Morey makes mistakes, that's fine. He's not going to be perfect, and we have a long track record with Daryl. He's going to be fine. If Tillman Fertitta won't spend even to the luxury tax level, that's a pretty big competitive disadvantage that, in this market, probably not even James Harden is going to be enough to overcome. So that's why, given the stakes, I view assuming that he's this cheapskate that will never even pay the tax, despite what he said on the record, that's a pretty serious allegation. And until I have more evidence, I'm not willing to make that assumption. I think it's premature. I think the trade deadline with Shumpert, it is part of the evidence when you truly look at it that suggests there's a lot more to it than just trying to cut costs and trying to fit into certain salary slots. But I think the buyout market, potentially Daniel House Jr., we'll see what happens with that, but certainly what we've already seen with Markieff Morris has provided even more evidence of that. More on that in the third and final segment momentarily. So we spent the second segment of our Tillman Fertitta show dissecting the trade deadline and why the moves that led to Iman Shumpert and his slightly lower salary were not all a cleverly and carefully put together financial savings plan. The Rockets had larger goals, and unfortunately, those bigger names did not work out. They pivoted to Shumpert, someone they've liked for a while, and they were close enough to the deadline, or to the tax line, excuse me, that they said, you know what, let's get under. And on the record, Tillman Fertitta has said since then they might not even finish under the tax. We'll have to wait and see. And I should be clear, I'm not saying that you should take Tillman Fertitta's word at face value. For example, I saw the quote that he gave Jonathan Fagan about the luxury tax not having any role in their decisions. Do I believe that? No. I think that's an extreme overstatement, but a lot of owners speak that way. It's media speak, as I look at it. So no, I don't believe every word out of his mouth. However, if I think there are certain exaggerations, that doesn't also mean that I have to assume that every word is a lie. That is a major overreach. And I think the proof is in the pudding, at least to some degree, with some of the moves that have transpired or not transpired since the trade deadline, specifically Markieff Morris, who has been well reported as a Rockets target, and the ongoing dance with Daniel House Jr., who is out of days on his existing two-way contract. I'll start with Markieff Morris because there's more that's known on that front. The Rockets went after him. Fertitta said on the record to Jonathan Fagan that the move, alluding to that, would have pushed them back into tax territory, which suggests the Rockets would have been willing to dip into their mid-level exception money to sign Morris because they could have afforded a minimum deal and still been underneath the tax. Well, apparently they were offering, or at least in Fertitta's words, more than the minimum because it would have pushed them into tax territory. But even if you don't view it as fully accurate, even if you're skeptical that they were offering the mid-level exception, the reality is they were not outbid. We know that now because Morris ended up signing with the Oklahoma City Thunder for the minimum. It was not about money. It was about role. And I'm sure some will say, well, what if the Rockets had offered more money in Oklahoma City? Well, they couldn't have offered much more. You're talking about a basically $1.3 million prorated, so it wouldn't have been much of an upgrade. Again, we have seen numerous players turn down better situations, either financially or in terms of contending for the sake of role. Wes Matthews, Wayne Ellington, we have seen it time and time again. Players see the upside of being in a better spot to put up numbers, to get minutes, and get a better salary in the coming summer as much more valuable to them than, say, a chance at a cheap ring at the end of a bench or maybe $1 million extra on a prorated basis for one season. The point is, Markieff Morris wanted to be in Oklahoma City. He went there for the minimum. And by the way, the Thunder have even more than their mid-level exception left than the Rockets do. So it's not just a matter of the Rockets being the only team that's unwilling to spend it. No, the Thunder are a tax team. They're not willing to spend that MLE either. So with Markieff, that was his preference. You can speculate if you want, I suppose, of what would have happened if the Rockets offered him what was left of their MLE. Number one, it's pretty clear that Fertitta is saying that they did. But even if you don't fully believe that, then at the same time, how can you look at it as some huge failure on ownership only if, in the worst-case scenario, the Rockets were offering the same deal as the Thunder, which is the minimum, and yet Morris just wanted to be there in part or in large part for reasons we've outlined for weeks now. There's a more clear role for him, usurping Patrick Patterson as basically the third big man up front for them behind Steven Adams and Jeremy Grant. And I've seen a lot of wondering about this strategy the Rockets had of not spending their mid-level exception in the offseason, because the leak, not on the record, but through sources, was that they're planning to use the mid-level exception in buyout season to give them a financial leg up on guys like Markieff Morris, who then the Rockets didn't land. They were also rumored to be interested in Wes Matthews and Wayne Ellington, and as mentioned earlier, they didn't land those guys either. Why can't you look at that as a Daryl Morey mistake? I'm not saying that it is, but I think there's a pretty compelling argument you can make that perhaps the Rockets and other teams overvalued how much a slight financial edge on a prorated, basically one-third of a season contract. I think you can make an argument that saving that money is not as valuable to the player as being in a better position to get minutes and to be seen as lucrative in the summer for their next contract, because most bought-out guys, they sign a one-year deal, so they're free agents the coming summer. Why does it have to be some carefully orchestrated financial ruse to make you think that, oh, we're going to spend and then don't? Why couldn't it be just a mistake that perhaps the Rockets were more optimistic than they should have been about how much the leftover MLE would be worth in buyout season? Again, I can't prove it, but what I am telling you is that there is a plausible case that it's a Daryl Morey issue and not a Tillman Fertitta issue. And as mentioned earlier, yes, Daryl Morey makes mistakes. James Ennis, Michael Carter-Williams, Carmelo Anthony, they swung and missed quite a few times. Now, Daryl Morey, I'm not criticizing the guy because he's one of the best in the league. He is more than made up for that. He hits way more than he misses, so it's fine. But it doesn't mean that he doesn't miss. So there's no reason to make this unfounded assumption of a guy that you barely know in Tillman Fertitta. Let the situation play out. The final point I want to make, and this is the ongoing situation, is with Daniel House Jr. The only stated request from House and his agent, or through his agent, I should say, since he ran out of days on his existing two-way contract, was to be converted on a one-year minimum deal to become a free agent this summer. And the Rockets, technically he would be restricted, but they'd be limited with the Rockets as a well above the cap team. They would only be able to retain him beyond the minimum by using their exceptions, the biannual or the mid-level exception, which I think is currently targeted for guys like Kenneth Fareed and Austin Rivers. And beyond that, if the bidding goes above and beyond those levels, then there's nothing they can do to match. So restricted does not mean restricted in the case of Daniel House Jr. So the Rockets, they countered with a three-year minimum deal. And to this point, House and his agent have not accepted that. And I've seen some arguing, well, why won't the Rockets offer a three-year mid-level deal, what's left, starting at about $3.5 million a year, and assuming that the reason that has not been done is because of Tillman Fertitta's willingness or lack thereof to spend. The argument I've seen is that for the Rockets, getting a player like House for 3 years at $3 million a year is a coup. That it's exactly what they should want to do with their mid-level exception to get cheap young talent controlled within the organization. And my response to that is, yes, it is. But if it was that simple, why has House and his agent not outwardly said that this is what they want? Why is the only statement on the record about the conversion? And the reason it is, if 3 years at $3 million a year is advantageous to the Rockets, a lot of other teams are probably going to see it the same way too. So it's very possible that House thinks that he's got lucrative offers better than that. Perhaps he's already been told, his agent behind the scenes, waiting for him this summer when a lot of teams are going to have cap room. And guess what? A lot of teams would see a young player in his mid-20s at 3-and-D wing as a desirable commodity. There is nothing to indicate that House would clearly even accept the 3-year offer if you were willing to offer. Now, I'm not saying that it shouldn't be discussed as a compromise scenario, but at this point, number one, we haven't seen evidence that it hasn't been. And secondly, part of the reluctance, why would you do it once you've already been through this process? They went after Markieff Morris. You're now within 5 days of March 1st. At this point, why would you not go to the deadline, see what happens, make sure you know the market before you commit your funds? There is no harm at this point in waiting, especially if the upside, who knows? Maybe you could get House, leverage him into the 3-year minimum deal that you initially wanted. Do y'all realize how much leverage that House could get if they leak the story that, well, we're willing to play 3 years for what's left in the mid-level exception, and the Rockets, they won't offer it because the owner doesn't want to go into luxury tax? You realize how much public pressure that would put on Tillman Fertitta, considering how good Daniel House Jr. looked and how many fans want him back? In my estimation, that's a card that House and his agent would love to play. It would put a lot of public pressure from the Rockets fan base onto Tillman Fertitta if all that is left between the Rockets and House is money and being willing to spend that small portion of the mid-level exception, which really isn't that much above the minimum. That's why I don't believe that's the real issue. I think it comes down to the fact that they want that 1-year conversion, and they think that the remainder of this year at the minimum, plus whatever they get this summer in free agency, is going to be better financially than a 3-year deal at about, say, $3.5 billion a year, what's left of the mid-level exception. I'm not saying that there's no merit to the other side. I'm not saying it's impossible. All I'm saying is that there is a pretty compelling case, in my estimation, again, the only public statement on the record from Raymond Brothers, the agent of Daniel House, is requesting the 1-year conversion. There's a lot of leverage, if it was just about money, that they could exert on the Rockets. They have not done that. In my estimation, it's because they want the 1-year conversion, and that's not about money. That's simply about how Daniel House Jr. can position himself for his next contract. And with the Rockets, it's not that they won't offer more money, it's that they can't because they're over the tax, they're limited in what they can offer, and combine that with Kenneth Reed, Austin Rivers, and others being free agents, they need to use the mid-level exception and biannual exception on other players. So in closing, because I've gone a little bit longer than I planned, this is not an issue, in my opinion, that is solely about Tillman Fertitta. A lot of these aren't. It's just he is the easy target to blame. If these things play out and there's more time ahead, I'm willing to change my opinion. I'm not asking you to believe that Tillman Fertitta is a great owner. In my opinion, it's too soon to tell. All I'm asking you to do is take a step back, breathe, and as long as there are plausible alternatives, which they clearly are for most of these situations, to explain the Rockets' action or inaction beyond just unwilling to spend, then I don't know why you would jump to the conclusion that 100% that Tillman Fertitta is a cheapskate and he's never going to spend and some of the narratives that we've seen. Because that's a fatal flaw. Unlike a GM who makes a mistake, you can learn from that. I don't think an owner that's unwilling to go into the tax, even for this team, is suddenly going to spend more money. If he's unwilling to do it now, the odds are, and when I say unwilling to do it now, I mean for reasons other than the repeater tax, which would clearly be a strategic maneuver to give them more taxability in future years. If he's unwilling to pay the tax regardless, it's going to be pretty tough to win a championship in Houston in the modern NBA. That's the reality. I don't know why you would go there if you're a Rockets fan prematurely. You can be cautious. You can be skeptical. I'm not saying you need to buy in. I'm not preaching homerism or anything like that. I'm just saying take a deep breath, relax, and let's let these situations play out. For now, this is where I'll leave it. If you want more content before our next show, which will be much more game-related, the best place to get it is on Twitter. I'm on there at Ben Dubose. Show is on there at Locked On Rockets. Also got an email address, lockedonrockets@gmail.com, a Facebook account, facebook.com/lockedonrockets, a website, lockedonrockets.com. Always you can access our prior content, or you can contact me questions about the show, suggestions for it, advertising inquiries, things you want to know about the team, whatever it may be, don't hesitate to reach out. I would love to hear from you and hopefully improve this experience for you as a diehard Rockets fan or even just as a human being. Also, if you haven't subscribed already, please do. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify. You can find us on so many platforms that are part of a great network of shows at the Locked On Podcast Network. Subscribe, leave 5-star reviews. That's how we can look attractive to potential advertisers, even if you don't advertise yourself. Subscribe, leave 5-star reviews. That's how we can look attractive to potential advertisers and keep this business model rolling as the only daily podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. So for now, this is where we'll break it, but please come back soon for more episodes as we break down Monday night's Rockets-Hawks game. Rockets have a chance to go back to 10 games over 500 at 60 games. We put them at 35-25. Certainly not where they want to be, but better than where they've been, at least relative to just 48 hours ago. So until then, have a great start to your week, and please come back soon for more episodes right here at Locked On Rockets, your home for daily coverage of Houston Rockets basketball.